Up next, demonology. Our special guest, Michelle Ballanger, joins us. She's back with us. Some of her books include Conspiracy of Angels, The Dictionary of Demons. Website, Facebook, and Twitter linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you. Michelle Ballanger is back with us, a religious studies scholar, occult expert. She is the author of a number of books, at least 30 plus now, on paranormal and occult topics. Michelle is most widely recognized for appearances on the A&E's hit Paranormal State, a variety of History Channel documentaries, and also Portals to Hell on the Travel Channel. Her recent ventures include the purchase and renovation of a haunted 1870s home dubbed Inspiration House for use as a teaching space and retreat center. Michelle, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. I hope you're having a great night.
I sure am, and I love talking about demons. As long as they stay away from me, I'm happy about that.
Here's hoping.
How did you get involved in studying demonology?
I was raised Catholic, and I went to a Catholic university. I was a National Merit Scholar, and initially I started off in psychology, and one of my problems with the psychology department was they were doing a lot less of really dealing with people's problems on like a core personal level. It was all about kind of pushing pills on them.
Yeah.
And where I really found my calling was more about helping people with, you know, really their spiritual issues. So I ended up in the religious studies department, and particularly in comparative religious studies, because, you know, for me, God was way too big for one religion, and I was fascinated with all the different beliefs that people had. I had a couple of fantastic professors, and in the years that I went there, Dr. Joseph Kelly, who was the head of the religious studies department, offered a course in demonology, and that pretty much had me hooked. He took an approach to it that was not merely theological, and wasn't simply about Catholic beliefs in the personification of evil, but we looked at myths and beliefs around the world. And it was fascinating to find how many things people had in common, especially when it came to their idea of personified evil, like the forces that may or may not be arranged against us in the world, and then how people deal with that, and how far back those beliefs really go.
Well, that's a good point, too. And in terms of demonology, it's been practiced since almost the beginning of time, hasn't it?
At the roots of Western civilization, if you go back to the city between the rivers, the Fertile Crescent, so Sumer, Babylon, most of the beliefs and practices that we have for what constitutes possession and even the rites of exorcism, you can find them almost word for word back in the cuneiform tablets that have come down to us. And notably, the names of the gods and goddesses obviously change. Most of them are replaced with archangels. In the Catholic rite,
mm-hmm.
But you know, if you put them side by side to the Roman ritual, several of the passages are identical, and key ideas of getting the name of the demon. I know in a lot of the paranormal shows, and even a couple of them that I've been on, there's this sort of fear that if you say the name, that's going to attract the attention, that that's going to summon it. But at the very core, and this goes back in, it's reflected in the Bible as well, knowing the name is essential also to compel, to bind, and to cast it out.
With these demons, are they fallen angels? Are they, the departed dead souls of, you know, people who were evil when they were alive? What are they?
Well, that's where it gets interesting, because one man's demon is another man's god. And while almost every religious tradition around the world has some belief in personified evil and spirits that are ranged against humanity, they don't all agree on exactly what they are. Obviously, in the Judeo-Christian system, they are fallen angels or evil angels. There's some difference in the Jewish approach because they've got a much starker sense of monotheism, where everything bows to God, and therefore even an evil angel is still carrying out a part of God's plan. Now, that changes a little bit in Christianity, where you definitely have this whole faction that breaks off, and they're not merely evil angels carrying out the darker side of that plan, necessary evil, but they are things that have rebelled against the order and therefore are fallen angels. But that idea of demons, spirits that are trying to possess, harm, bring chaos upon the world, that predates the idea of damnation and redemption. It predates the Christian tradition. It predates the Jewish tradition. And at the very core, they are usually beings that stand somewhere between humans and God or the gods. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit elevated above us and therefore more powerful. They are non-human. They often can never have had a chance to take human form, but they are still tied here, still wound up in human affairs. And because they're not necessarily a part of our world, they're often also jealous of it.
Michelle, are they acting on their own? Is there somebody or something directing them? I mean, whose control are they under?
Again, that depends on the culture that they're coming from. In the Judeo-Christian system, there's a head honcho. And ironically, not all of the books agree on who that is. If we go strictly with the Christian biblical tradition, of course, that's going to be Satan. But if you go to the Jewish books, Satan originally is just a job description, and there's multiple people who hold that role. And that's particularly reflected in the book of Job and in some extra biblical texts. As the mythology evolves, Satan, Lucifer, Beelzebub, different people identify different lords of hell. The Dead Sea Scrolls have an interesting take on it, where the Essenes, they were the sect that the Dead Sea Scrolls were written by, and they were poised right at the cusp between Messianic Judaism and Christianity. And so they reflect this really fascinating time where ideas were developing, and a lot of things that come down to us were developing. And they identified the armies of light and the armies of darkness. So the warriors of light were headed by Michael, who we recognize as Michael the Archangel in the Christian tradition. And they identify Belial or Belial as the head of wickedness, the head of the sons of darkness. And there's a few fragmentary quotes in the Dead Sea Scrolls that come down to us that talk about them, and basically talk about them as the opposing chiefs of those two sides.
You don't like to be called a demonologist. How come?
Well, first of all, I've run across a number of people who will very haphazardly claim the title. I mean, I'm not a theological expert, or at least I won't take a theological position on it, especially as a comparative religious studies scholar. I approach it from mythological and folklore, and, you know, I really acknowledge that everybody has some validity to their beliefs, but I don't think everybody's got all the pieces. And the more I study about the idea of demons and demonology, the deeper that rabbit hole goes. I don't know that anybody can have or claim full expertise on it. I think it's a much bigger topic than any one of the religious approaches allows for.
You worked with Lorraine Warren, part of Ed Warren's group, I guess, and she just passed away last April, just a month ago. Ed passed away back in 2006. But they were incredible paranormal investigators and authors, and of course, you couldn't talk about a paranormal issue where they weren't part of or they knew about. She's going to be missed. What was it like working with her?
She and I got the pleasure to work with her on several Paranormal State episodes. She was really kind of the grand dam of the paranormal.
Oh yeah.
As Ed's wife, she really dedicated herself to carrying on his legacy. She was extremely firm in her beliefs, very much a product of her time, a product of her background. She and I definitely disagreed on a few points. One of my most memorable moments with her, we were doing an investigation for Paranormal State, and Lorraine had some very hardline beliefs of, like, what would draw demons and evil into someone's life? What would make them vulnerable? Among some of the things that she considered to be damning portals were Ouija boards, books of magic and witchcraft, tarot decks.
I think she was right there.
So we were at a home where she and I both had agreed that the daughter's room was one of the only places in the house that didn't seem to have any activity. And later, when we were doing the actual ghost hunt part of the investigation, it happened that we found underneath the daughter's bed a Ouija board and several books of magic. And I recognized actually the type of magic, and it was some darker stuff, to be honest. So, you know, of course, Lorraine was like, uh-oh. I mean, she immediately wanted to know, A, what had gone on with that stuff, and sort of changed her opinion of the haunting to want to point the finger at these items. And the thing was, is I'd gotten a very different read from the daughter's room, and I spent about 30 minutes with Lorraine. Of course, this all is on the cutting room floor. To go, why don't we talk to the daughter? Because tools and things like that, symbols like that, it's really in the hands of the person who's using it. So the question was, had the kid used it? Was this actually going to be like the secret reason for the problems at the house, even though that wasn't the impression we'd gotten at all? So, I mean, long story short, we sat down. I'd convinced Lorraine not to just react to the stuff. We sat down with the daughter and we found out that the items had been gifted to her by an aunt who had passed away. And the daughter had never touched them. She just didn't feel that she could throw them out because she felt fondly of the aunt. We talked about proper handling of such things, especially the books of magic. They were, I'm pretty open-minded, but they were questionable.
Some skeptics have looked at their work and, you know, they say these things didn't happen, like Amityville Horror, that house, that it just didn't happen. How could they, you know, be on so many opposite ends of the spectrum with a story like that?
I'll be honest, I have been in some situations where if I had not personally witnessed what went on, I'm not sure I would have believed it. Actually, I can say for sure. Like if I were watching it on TV, if I was hearing someone else report it,
right,
I would have a hard time believing it. And, you know, even in the thick of it, there are experiences that you can have that the next day in the light of morning, you kind of would feel more comfortable convincing yourself that they didn't happen.
But
some of it also comes down to an interpretation. Like with the Ouija board and the magic books in that particular investigation, like I said, Lorraine definitely was a product of her time. So she had some very, very hard line interpretation of things. And, you know, a psychic is only as good as their interpretations.
Absolutely.
I don't want to disparage, you know, any of her conclusions and any of what she was doing. What I can say is having known the woman, I do not believe that she would ever have hoaxed anything.
Right.
Do I think that she might sometimes misinterpret something? She was human, so I think everybody's prone to that.
Embellish?
No, I don't think that was really in her nature to embellish. To be very, very intensely affected by something and then interpret it through her lens, yes. But embellish, no. I really don't think that was something that she would do.
Do we know what it was that got Ed and Lorraine involved in this field in the first place? I mean, they started a New England Society for Psychic Research back in 1952. I mean, my God, 67 years ago. But do we know if there was some case or some issue that really got them going?
I think it was something that Ed went through. She didn't speak too elaborately about that. To be honest with you, she spoke to me more about her pet chickens and her spaniels or Isle of Skye.
They weren't demons, were they?
No, but she was intensely an animal person.
Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, I know. Chickens were a little weird for me, but she had Einstein and Henrietta. She would fret over them when she was on cases. What I can say is, you know, listening to her talk about Ed, that man was the light of her life. And wherever he went, she followed. I know that she loved him especially because he took her abilities in stride. He encouraged her not to fear them, but to embrace them and to work with them and use them for good. And, you know, she did an awful lot of work that I think helped a lot of people who felt that they were in crisis. And certainly methods might have been controversial. Within the Catholic Church, for example, performing an exorcism, even now, is still it's a very rarefied thing. And the Catholic Church is pretty particular about who does and does not get to perform, at least the Catholic rite of exorcism, or even who gets to declare what is, you know, genuinely a possession. I know ultimately Ed and Lorraine got an opportunity to work with the church and with priests. And, you know, even then, it's still, it's such a dodgy topic for people.
Has Hollywood exaggerated these fields?
Yeah, I mean, it's unavoidable with television. And it's not just Hollywood, but even the paranormal shows. And, you know, this is, as speaking as someone who has been on several of them.
Well, they have to have something exciting. They can't just do a 30-minute program or an hour and not have anything happen. So they really have to either make it up or, you know, dramatize it or something, because not every paranormal event is going to create a ghost or a spirit.
No, and that's true. I was actually just having a conversation the other day with people about ghost hunting is about as boring as deer hunting. You know, you sit around in the dark, in the cold, wondering whether or not that crack of a twig was actually the thing you were looking
exactly.
for.
Exactly. And if it doesn't happen, it really is boring.
Yeah. And, you know, for especially like paranormal shows, if most of the teams that I know who are on TV are genuine, but production companies still have to do some sort of hype with it. And, you know, the jump scares are like that cut where somebody off camera has dropped something that has nothing to do with the investigation whatsoever. Everybody's head turns rapidly, and that's where they will cut and then, like, imply that something has happened. And I think that will lead viewers to get a little, more than a little skeptical.
It is. It's disappointing.
It is. Oh, no. As somebody who's been on it, one of the things that really makes me a little, that really burns my britches, is we've had some extraordinary stuff happen that doesn't make it to the shows, I think because it's too genuine and too scary. And yet they'll kind of devolve to some of the jump scares. And I've never quite understood those decisions. It's not every show, but I can say definitely, like with Paranormal State, I can think of two or three of the episodes where what we experienced and what we really thought was going on wasn't the story the production company wanted to spin, and so what they cut out of the episode, the looks on the faces of the folks who had to review the footage.
Mm-hmm.
There was a gal who struggled with demonic possession. I'd asked expressly not to be involved in this case. I really didn't want to get tangled with it.
Why?
But
too close to it?
You know, at the time, I really didn't want to get sucked into standing by in any possession or exorcism stuff.
Okay.
Later on in the show, I ended up having to help on some things with Father Bob particularly. But I really approached exorcism in practice very, very cautiously. I had some skepticism for how quickly some people might jump to the conclusion that someone was possessed. And I was hesitant until I learned that, you know, for Paranormal State, they always had a psychologist on call as well. If there was any chance, any talk that this was possession.
Hold on, Michelle. We'll come back and talk more about this. Also, I want to get in more into the Catholic Church and what they're doing too. And we're back with Michelle Balanger as we talk about her work as a demonologist. Michelle, you're a Catholic. I'm a Catholic. The Catholic Church has been very active lately in studying demons. They have opened up their exorcism classes. They're getting more exorcists all over the place. What can you tell us about what the Catholic Church is doing on record about this?
Well, they've started up demonology and exorcism courses, and you know, typically that's been exclusively for Catholics, Catholic priests, and you know, very guarded territory. And that is not to say that the rite of exorcism isn't something that you find in, you know, other Christian traditions as well as other traditions, other religions right across the board. But, you know, our popular portrayal, partly because of the movie The Exorcist, what people identify with classic exorcism is very much the Roman ritual. They've opened their doors to not merely Catholics at this point. They are concerned enough by a rise in what they believe to be, you know, genuine cases of possession across the globe that they want to arm more than just their priests, which is unprecedented.
That's huge news, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely huge. Like not something that has ever happened before. I mean, when I'd seen the news bite about it, I started, like, digging around on the Internet. Because, of course, we live in the world where you have to, like, find five different citations for something that you read on any news feed to make sure that it's actually really true.
That's true. You're right. I have to look at these things now 10 times before I go on the air with it going, is this real? I've got a couple sources that are, you know, impeccable, but you still never know, especially on the Internet.
Yeah, no, and so, like, double checking. But, you know, it is a week-long Vatican course, and it's an international series on, I think the title is Exorcism and the Prayer of Liberation. And it's, what, 300 euros or so? So what is that? It's probably 360, about under $400.
Not a lot to become an exorcist.
No, really not a lot at all for like, the level of instruction.
Well, and I guess they give you a certificate too, right? You're certified.
I would imagine
something that proves that you are who you are.
Yeah, no, and that's important. That's actually one of the reasons why I resist calling myself a demonologist. You know, I've got the scholarly background, but again, there's just so many people who just kind of put on the demonologist.
Right, you've not been authenticated, basically.
Well, the problem is, you know, having sat in on some things that were pretty hairy, that is not something I would suggest anybody try to do after reading just one book. Like, that's dangerous territory, not just for the person who they're trying to help, but for anybody else in that room.
Now,
and, you know, there's strict... go ahead.
Well, why do you think the Catholic Church opened up these courses and certifications to other people who are non-Catholic?
Well, first of all, I think we've got a pretty fantastic Pope who is progressive and open-minded. And on top of that, the demonologists with the Church have been really kind of pounding the drums of we're in a time where things are getting intense. And I think it only makes sense at that point to be more ecumenical about it.
Well, that could be, absolutely. Now, originally, what created demons, possessions? Was it mainstream religion? How did it start in the first place? And I'm talking about way back since the beginning of time.
If we go back to Sumer Babylon, their idea of a possession, which is almost one for one what we identify as possession, the possessed person, first of all, the things that they identified as demons were non-human entities that were intelligent and malevolent and expressly focused on disrupting the human sphere. They were bringers of chaos and disease and destruction. They were often personified as these massive forces of nature, but, you know, took particular interest in individuals. They would overshadow them first, cause illness, but ultimately try to crawl under their skin. Like, get into the person and then wreak harm through the person. The methods of driving that out, fascinatingly, we see an echo in the gerasene demoniac in, I think it's in Luke and in Mark. Everybody knows this section out of the Bible because it's where I am legion comes from. And it's the fellow who Jesus comes across him, and he's got a legion of demons in him. Jesus ultimately demands their name. They answer that they're legion, and Jesus casts them out into a herd of swine, which then go careening off a cliff and die, presumably, killing the demons. The time period, the culture that occurs in, those folks would recognize that as a very classic method of exorcism because that's how it was done all the way back to Sumer and Babylon. They would get the name of the possessing entity. They would drive it out, usually into a substitute, often an animal, sometimes a figurine, but usually something like a pig or a goat that would then be sacrificed, thereby killing the demon that was caught in it, because you really didn't want to do that to the person.
Right. Right. I mean, there is that possibility you could end up killing the person, trying to get the demon.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why exorcism has been a very controversial thing, because sometimes that has happened. It has happened on record. It has been a result in instances where the folks performing the exorcism felt very firm that what they were doing was right. Having watched Father Bob battle a couple of things, the folks who are possessed or who are manifesting all of the signs of being possessed do not go quietly and can get violent. And so I can understand why there are circumstances where people are held down or occasionally bound and tied down because, you know, frankly, one of the signs of demonic possession, because the Catholic Church used to be very strict, and I think still is, they have a checklist of things that a person has to manifest for them to identify it as genuine possession. You know, obviously, psychological and psychiatric issues have to be ruled out, and, you know, those are, psychiatrists are involved these days with assessing it. But, you know, a person will exhibit strength that is beyond their mortal frame, and, you know, that's right there on the checklist. Xenoglossia, which is speaking in tongues, mm-hmm. Exhibiting languages that they never had exposure to, that they had no opportunity to learn, exhibiting knowledge, because the things that we believe we're dealing with, they're smarter than your average bear, that's for sure. Yeah, you know, they're more tuned into things and will come up with some of the darndest stuff comes out of their mouths in the middle of stuff. That much I can attest to.
What creates the possession in the first place? I mean, what do they do to get their guard down?
Well, there's a lot of different opinions on that. If you go back to the roots of Western demonology and the tradition of possession and exorcism, sometimes nothing at all. Like, you just pulled the short straw. You caught something's attention, and maybe you were just not feeling well enough that week. Maybe you didn't propitiate the right God, but sometimes it's just bad things happen to good people. Now, as we've moved forward here and now, there's generally the idea that somehow you've invited it in, that there's some lapse in your life.
Like with a Ouija board, maybe.
Well, some of the most convincing letting things in. I'll fall back on one of the ones that I sat in on, and this was an instance that Father Bob was involved in, and I will say that in my opinion that there was definitely a possessing entity. The individual had a history of drugs and alcohol, so addiction was a significant issue for him. And it was the opinion, not merely of Father Bob, but also of the psychologist who was working with us, that was the crack that let this start to get into his life. And I find that, honestly, a much more credible crack than just picking up, you know, a cursed item or whatnot.
Well, that could be. Now, you also have, you still have this haunted house?
Yeah. It's the coziest haunting. So I train people who are...
What's a coziest haunting?
So it's a house that was built 1869, 1870, mm-hmm. and it's had a series of owners, many of whom lived 30, 40 years. Like they lived and they died in the houses, in the house. And they are, in my opinion, the ghosts that haunt that house are people who simply loved it too much to want to leave. They're not violent. They're not negative. They're intelligent. And it was the best haunting I could find as kind of a place for psychic training wheels, for folks who are working with spirits, who are learning to discern the difference between a negative haunting and a good haunting, who are learning to assess their own abilities. It is the safest thing I could find.
But you enjoy it, obviously.
Yeah, actually, I spent some time getting to know the people who were there.
Is it relaxing?
You know, I find it interesting. I suppose it's not everybody's cup of tea. I was raised in a family where psychic abilities came down on both sides. And so spirits weren't necessarily a weird or scary thing growing up. Finding that there are certainly much nastier things out there than, you know, just, you know, dead Aunt Edna who just has never left upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different thing. But, you know, the house that I picked up in Oberlin is not everything needs to be driven out. I have a very firm stance on that. It was actually one of the things that Lorraine and I sometimes disagreed on professionally. I really didn't think that everything needed to be cast out of a house or anything. Like, in some cases, sometimes our dead loved ones come back to watch over us. And, you know, it's their choice to come back. And they're not causing any trouble. Actually, they're there to help. The problem being that, you know, your average person can't tell the difference and isn't necessarily prepared to deal with the manifestation of the paranormal.
No,
it's scary even if it is well-intentioned.
Do you travel much, Michelle, to various locations?
A little bit less than I used to. I guess I'm getting stodgy in my old age. One of the reasons that I picked up Inspiration House was I really wanted to have the opportunity to have students come to me rather than have me go all over the place. But, you know, I will still go. There are several teams that I work with, and if the need arises and if I'm a good fit for what they need, I will travel.
Well, travel is, of course, important to the people who need your help, because there aren't a lot of people like you that have that ability to investigate. And I probably assume you cleanse a house too, can't you?
Yeah, I do. I work with the religious background of the folks who live in the house. And that was another thing that, like, really I respected with the Warrens. You know, they were Catholic. And Lorraine was Catholic till the day she breathed mm-hmm. her last.
And they were all business, devoutly. Weren't they?
They were all business. And one of the things that they highly valued was working with the religious system of the client. It was an immensely respectable stance because, you know, the language of belief is different around the globe. But the belief itself, like this human impulse to recognize something bigger than ourselves, that's something that unites us all. And so they would go in, and I do the same. Like, you go in and you find what speaks to the people, because finding what they have faith in and what can guide their faith is what will arm them best if it is a dangerous or a dark haunting.
Interesting take. Michelle, give out your website, please.
It's my first and last name, michellebelanger.com.
Simple as that. And Facebook, you're on Facebook as well, and Twitter, right?
Yep. Yeah, Facebook, Twitter. Honestly, if you just Google me, I think I come up for, like, the first 20 pages at this point.
All right, we're going to take phone calls with you next hour, of course, as we talk about demons and demonic possession. Have you ever felt that you were in danger with all of this?
There was one case that we did in, I think it was Rochester, New York, that I really didn't want to walk into the house. It felt bigger than what I wanted to tangle with. I went and did my work anyway, and it had an interesting ending because the person that I was brought in to assess was the wife, and it was her partner that I felt was connected to things. And the minute that I called him out on that, we were pretty much given the bum's rush on that one.
Interesting. Michelle, we're going to come back. We'll talk more and take phone calls with you at our final hour with you next on Coast to Coast AM.